Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Tante, a podcast that has walked toward the middle of Canto 13 of Purgatorio. We're going to be at lines 46 through 72. We're on the second terrace of Purgatory proper. We've come through all of the penitents who are waiting to get into the gate. We've come through the gate itself in Canto 9. We've been on the Terrace of Pride, the first terrace, for a long time, and now we have found out that we are on the second terrace, that is, the Terrace of Envy. This is my English translation of the passage, Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 46 through 72. You can find it on my website, as I always tell you, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. And other than that, let's read on. More than at first, I then opened wide my eyes. I gazed up ahead and saw shades with cloaks indistinguishable from the color of the rock. And when we'd advanced a little more, I heard their cries, "Mary, pray for us." They also cried out, "Michael and Peter and all the saints." I don't believe there walks on the earth these days a guy so hardened that he wouldn't have been run through by compassion because of what I saw next. To wit, when I got close enough to them, I could make out for certain how they were situated, so much so that my eyes were milked of heavy sorrows. They seemed to be clothed in cheap haircloth. Each one permitted another to lean on his shoulder, and the cliff permitted them all to lean back against it. In the same way, the blind, who lack anything to live on, often stand together at a specific spot for alms to beg for what they need, one leaning his head to rest on the shoulder of another. In this way, pity can get quickly telegraphed, not only by the sounds of their words, but by their very appearance, which is no less a goad for action. And just as the sun doesn't make landfall for the blind, in like manner, these shades about whom I'm speaking now were not granted the largesse of heaven's light. For each one had his eyelids perforated and stitched shut with an iron wire, as we might do to a wild hawk that refuses to remain calm. That is a gory end to this passage. Eyes stitched shut with wire. A scene from the sort of movie I would never watch on my own. Let's look at this passage in several ways. I'd like to look at it first as just two different pieces, Dante and the penitents, and then the long windup to actually what these penitents are. Then I'd like to talk for a bit about falcons and eyes and how this all relates. And finally, I'd like to call your attention to a very surprising thing that arises in this passage. Oh, there's some suspense for you. So let's get started. Let's start with the first 12 lines, and I'll read it through, kind of talking it through, and then I want to talk about a few larger issues. More than at first, I then opened wide my eyes, and you remember that in our last passage, Virgil had said, fix your eyes hard, gaze really steadily on what's ahead, and it's apparently difficult to make out these shades from the overall livid color of the landscape, the blue-gray emptiness that is all around us. So Dante does. He gazes up ahead, as Virgil has required him to do, and he sees the shades, and they've got cloaks on that are indistinguishable from the color of the rock. So their clothing has that bluish-gray color to it. And when we'd advanced a little more, I heard their cries, "Mary, pray for us." They also cried out, "Michael and Peter and all the saints." They're praying the litany of the saints. This is usually a prayer recited, at least in Dante's day, on Easter Vigil and at baptisms. You'll notice two things that are going on here. One, their prayer is fragmentary. It's just pieces. Mary, pray for us, Michael, Peter, all the saints. It's interesting that not more of the prayer is dropped here. Does this relate to the disembodied voices we had whipping around the mountain? Maybe. Does it show us that the complete prayer can't be heard by Dante? If so, then that would be a comment on Dante, not the penitents. Not sure I would agree with that. It's also curious that it's not in Latin. It's in medieval Florentine. This would be a litany prayer for the saints, or of the saints, recited mostly in Latin. And Dante has translated that prayer into medieval Florentine. That in and of itself is cause for pause. And I think that this will largely relate to what happens in the passage. We've talked a lot about alienation already and envy and its relationship to alienation. There is a way in which this vernacular statement of a Latin prayer is important for us to see, because ultimately the alienation fostered by envy will cause the disruption of the political state. I don't believe there walks on the earth these days a guy so hardened that he wouldn't have been run through by compassion because of what he saw next. This is a common topos, or a way to write, a common bit of subject matter. That is, you're so run through with pity that you would have to cry. In fact, this is such a common topos, or way to write, in the Middle Ages, that this same refrain, "you can't be so hard as not to cry," even finds its way into such a revered pieces as the Stabat Mater. Very common, comes out of the Bible. You'd have to be a really hard person not to cry over this. And what is it? Well, he says, to wit, "when I got close to them, I could make after certain how they were situated, so much so that my eyes were milked of heavy sorrows." And the verb here really is to milk. We should immediately think back to Inferno, where Dante is reprimanded for crying over the punishments of the damned. Here, there is no reprimand. Apparently, there is a proper time to cry over pain. Now, I just want to stop and say I have all kinds of problems with that. This leads you to really difficult and ethically charged moments in which you can say that pain is worth my compassion and that pain is not worth my compassion. Is compassion limited by circumstance? What if you just see suffering as deserving of compassion? Well, Dante wouldn't agree with me. He would not hold to my ethics. He would instead say there are moments that are appropriate for compassion here, and there are moments when it's not appropriate. All right, let's look at a couple really interesting things about these opening 12 lines. There's a lot of probing going on here. Dante opens his eyes wide. He gazes ahead. He tries to see these souls. Dante has been told to probe ahead with his eyes. He then gets up close to them, and then he's probed, or as the text says, he's run through or pierced with compassion. He gets even closer to them, and his eyes are milked, which would be a kind of rubbing or pulling action. So much probing. And then, of course, ultimately, this is going to come down to stitching the eyes shut. So much penetration, probing. I think this is really important to see, because probing is the root problem here. Envy stops interior probe. You don't worry about those for whom you're envious. You don't worry about their position, and instead you don't probe into them. We would also have to say this probing is part of letting people in. Notice that these souls are let in to Dante the Pilgrim. He's pierced by their sorrows, and he himself will try to be let into their world, but they will eventually hold him at arm's length. All of this kind of in and out, inside and outside, interiority and exteriority, that's a distinction, perhaps, that is really important to envy, to forget interiority and focus on exteriority, to focus on the position or fortune of people and not their interior states. I think we're being set up for that here with the continual emphasis on letting in and getting inside and getting further in with each step. Let's talk about what the answer is before we turn to the end of the passage. That is, what is the answer to envy? And it seems to be a kind of uniformity. These people are indistinguishable from the color of the rock. They all are speaking the same words. Mary, pray for us. Michael, Peter, all the saints. Notice the uniformity of their clothes. They seem to be clothed in cheap hair cloth. This is cloth knotted from horsehair, and it's particularly scratchy. Uniformity of color, uniformity of position, uniformity of vocality. All of this is part of what is being goaded forward as a cure to envy. And then uniformity in way, in the same way the blind who lack anything to live on often stand together. Again, this idea of holding together, they're leaning on each other, there's more uniformity toward you. Beggars in front of a church lean against each other and beg at certain times of the year or at certain services. They often stand together at a specific spot for alms, more uniformity, and then each one has his eyelids perforated and stitched shut. Still more uniformity. Uniformity is a solution to envy, and we're going to have to tease more of that out. Part of the problem here is that while Dante may want to claim that, he's going to actually have the souls on this terrace distinguish themselves, including the one who's sitting right in front of us, who we haven't quite got to yet, but she's right there, and they're going to distinguish themselves in very telling and personal ways. So while a kind of conformity or uniformity may be an answer to envy, there's also a way that the terrace itself fights against it. I think here for a moment about Soviet brutalism and Soviet, not brutality, but the architectural style of brutalism. And I think about that uniformity of the apartment blocks and how supposedly this mitigates the capitalist sin of envy that is the root problem of capitalism. Oh, how do I say this to you? My husband has a lot of his family in Israel, in Tel Aviv, but he also has a lot of his family who were still in Russia. And when he was a kid, he had a great aunt who visited from Russia all the time. And this is back in the Soviet days. And she actually got permission to come to the States and visit her family. She came twice to my husband's family in New York City and saw them and her brothers and sisters, etc. One of the things she was always horrified at is in the United States, there was not a uniformity. Bruce always tells the story that she was outraged that she would go in one store and a tuna sandwich was, I don't know, $2.95. And you go in another store and a tuna sandwich was $4.95. And she kept saying, as a good Soviet, well, how can this be? How come all tuna sandwiches aren't the same price? Because, of course, in the Soviet Union, they were all the same price. And I think about that as an answer to envy and the not satisfying way her outrage at the all different prices of tuna sandwiches is not satisfying. And I think here that Dante may be trying to answer the question of envy in a way that humans have, even in the Soviet Union, tried to answer it with a kind of Soviet bloc brutalist uniformity that doesn't always pay off. But certainly we would say it's part of what's going on here. Everyone is leveled. All right, let's look at the back bit of this passage. As I already told you, they seem to be clothed in cheap haircloth, sure enough, and each one permitted another to lean on his shoulder, and the cliff permitted them all to lean back against it. This leaning is yet another answer to envy, leaning on each other. Envy keeps you from leaning on each other. In the same way, the blind, who lack anything to live on, often stand together at a specific spot for alms to beg for what they need, one leaning his head to rest on the shoulder of another. We're being set up for the eyes sewn shut. But we're being set up in the longest possible way. In the same way the blind, when they beg, they lean on each other, and oh, here comes the blindness, and you know, we're really winding up to this. In this way, pity can get quickly telegraphed when people, the blind, are looking for alms in front of church services, not only by the sounds of their words, but by their very appearance, which is no less a goad for action. So they're leaning on each other. It looks pathetic. And just as the sun doesn't make landfall, really interesting verb here for the blind, make landfall, non approda, doesn't come to shore. The sun doesn't come to shore for the blind, based on the word proda, which is the word for sure. You should just know that this is such an unusual phrase that it is much debated among the early commentators. Some claim it actually means help or pleasure, but I personally like the bountiful ship metaphor, this ship coming in and making landfall, because A, we've been invited to the banquet table of love, and B, the beggars are leaning on each other, seeking to beg for what they need, for sustenance. So this idea of the sun as a bountiful ship making landfall, I think fits really beautifully with the overall metaphor that's going on here. Just as the sun, as the passage says, doesn't make landfall for the blind, in like manner these shades, and about whom I'm speaking now, I've noticed just how much Dante's delaying the payoff. We're not granted the largess of heaven's light. Still not telling me what's exactly going on here. Now, he does. For each one had his eyelids perforated and sewn shut with an iron wire, as we might do to a wild hawk that refuses to remain calm. Now it lands. Why set it up with so much metaphoric architecture about beggars in front of a church and leaning on each other? Why wind up so slowly to this? Perhaps, this is a little bit dicey and a little bit deconstructive, a little bit postmodern, but perhaps there's a way in which the reader is being goaded to patience with the text, that the reader is being goaded to let the text have its own way rather than rushing it to its answer. Maybe there is a way in which the reader is being withheld from envy of the plot. Seems too highfalutin, right? But let me have it. The reader is being held back from being envious of the motion of the plot and being kind of held in place by the words themselves. It's not a full and good explanation for what happens, but you do have to see that this thing is really held back. It's reined in. The rein is pulled tight on it. And we get this long windup to the big payoff, that their eyes are perforated and stitched shut. Well, their eyelids are perforated and stitched shut so that they themselves are blind. Let's talk about that for a minute. Each one, as it says at the end, has his eyelids perforated and stitched shut with an iron wire, as we might do to a wild hawk or a falcon that refuses to remain calm. Now, falcons' eyes are not sewn shut with iron wires. They were, especially in Dante's day, but even now, sewn shut with thread or gut thread, but not with iron wires. And why their eyelids? Why this? Well, in the Middle Ages, many people thought that envy, let me use the word, invidia, was related etymologically to in, I-N, meaning not, and videre, to see. So invidia, envy, is not being able to see. That's a false etymology, by the way, but it is certainly current in Dante's day, and he may be accepting it. What then is the cure for envy? I keep coming back to this. We know love is the cure, but how does it get expressed? In uniformity, as we've already discussed, in leaning against each other, as we've already discussed, in support, as we've seen with these penitents, in being let in to the interior space, as we will continue to see, as we start to see here, but continue to see in the passage. And also, well, I guess the cure for envy is to put your eyes out. Ugh. We want to talk a little bit more about that in the passage ahead, but let me just stop here and give you a bit of medieval folklore. When I was taught Dante by the medievalist Lois Roning, the now unfortunately passed on medievalist Lois Roning, I was told this the medieval folk tale, both here and for a bit in Chaucer, and let me tell it to you, as is the case in medieval folklore. An envious man and a greedy man are walking down a road together.
only be a folktale, right? So somebody's defined just by their one characteristic. Okay, so an envious man and a greedy man are walking down the road together, and the devil appears in front of them. And the devil says, I'll grant you each one of your wishes. And the envious man holds back in a kind of livid reticence, as the envious are. And he says, let him go first. So the greedy man instantly pipes up and says, oh, I'll have twice whatever he wishes for. So, of course, the greedy guy wants, you know, double whatever the envious man wants. And the envious man gets a really nasty smirk on his face and says, okay, put one of my eyes out. Thereby, of course, blinding fully the greedy man. This folkloric tale shows us part of the root of envy. It's not, I want to have what other people have. It's that I want other people to be more miserable than I am. It's not that I want your Tesla or I want your Rivian or I want your sapphire ring. No, I don't have those things, and so I'm miserable. And I want you to be even more miserable. Put one of my eyes out. I think that right here, by telling you that folkloric tale, we're kind of opening up envy to understanding it's about spreading misery. And here in this passage, we have these penitents leaning against each other in very reclining ways. I mean, leaning against reminds us instantly of the pose of the disciples at the Last Supper. It has this very intimate atmosphere of leaning against each other. You know, if we were out together somewhere and we were really good friends, and let's say we were sitting in a booth in a restaurant and you kind of leaned on me or I leaned on you and we continued to talk, you know how intimate that would be. I would be letting you weigh into my personal space. Well, that's kind of this. They're leaning into each other, very much in each other's space. And this surely is a way of comfort, not of spreading misery. Two interesting things about the back bit of this passage. When we get to that bit about the blind and how when they lack anything to live on, they often stand together at a specific spot for alms to beg for what they need. It's a backward glance to Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 133 through 135. If you remember, Provenzan Salvani stationed himself in the middle of the Sienese Campo in order to plead for mercy and plead for mercy for others. This is an important callback to Provenzan Salvani, since his kin is sitting right in front of us against the wall. So it's important to see that just as he sat out in the Campo, here we have people standing out. And there's a second callback here. These shades are not granted the largesse of the heaven's light or the bounty of the heaven's light. It starts to seem as if the sun is allegorical or not. We're back to that problem, right? So they've got their eyes sewn shut, so they can't see the light of the sun. So is that an allegorical function that they're shut off from divine wisdom? Or is the sun actually the naturalistic physical sun in the sky? And you could feel it pulling both ways. You could feel it pulling toward allegory, and you could feel it pulling toward naturalism. This is exactly what we were fighting in the front part of this canto. And it's calling back to that because it is the basic dilemma. What is the sun? Is it an allegory, or is it a thing in the sky, or is it both at once? And you know the answer. It's both at once, and yet it seems so often to be just naturalistic in these passages. Interesting callbacks on both counts, but one other callback, and this one is the biggest of all. Guess who else was blinded in comedy? It's kind of ridiculous. You don't have to guess at all, I'll tell you. So in real life, Pierre de la Vigne, the suicide, was blinded before he hung himself. And where does Pierre de la Vigne fall? In Inferno, Canto 13. And what canto are we in Purgatorio? 13. And what does Pierre say? He claims that envy. The vice of the court is responsible for his suicide. Oh, that's the first thing. So we've got a callback to Inferno 13. And a second thing, Pierre Lavagne's lord and master, Frederick II, Stupor Mundi, wrote a treatise with illustrations for how to stitch Falcon's eyes closed. Inferno 13, the Canto of the Suicides, is running around without a single doubt underneath Purgatorio, Canto 13. And we're going to continue to come back to Pierre de la Vigne because the soul sitting right in front of us, her speech is going to have call-outs back to Pierre de la Vigne in it. You see, comedy is far more complicated than at first blush. But let's forget all that and just read the passage straight through one more time. Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 46 through 72. More than at first, I then opened wide my eyes. I gazed up ahead and saw shades with cloaks indistinguishable from the color of the rock. And when we advanced a little more, I heard their cries, Mary, pray for us. They also cried out, Michael and Peter and all the saints. I don't believe there walks on the earth these days a guy so hardened that he wouldn't have been run through by compassion because of what I saw next. To wit, when I got up close to them, I could make out for certain how they were situated, so much so that my eyes were milked with heavy sorrows. They seemed to be clothed in cheap haircloth. Each one permitted another one to lean on his shoulder, and the cliffs permitted them all to lean back against it. In the same way, the blind, who lack anything to live on, often stand together at a specific spot for alms to beg for what they need, one leaning his head to rest on the shoulder of another. In this way, pity can get quickly telegraphed, not only by the sounds of their words, but by their very appearance, which is no less a goad for action. And just as the sun doesn't make landfall for the blind, in like manner these shades, about whom I'm speaking now, were not granted the largesse of heaven's light, for each one had his eyelids perforated and stitched shut with an iron wire, as we might do to a wild hawk that refuses to remain calm. We, for sure, will remain calm as we walk into Canto 13, as we find resonances with Pierre de la Vigne and the suicides up or down, I guess, down in Inferno. I guess not up for most, but okay, down in Inferno. And we're going to continue to walk on, as I've told you already, toward one of the most astounding souls in all of comedy. To get there, you have to subscribe to this podcast. If you don't mind rating it, that would be great. A rating, dare I ask, for 5 stars would be terrific. And if you write a review, even nice podcast, thank you so much for doing that. Thank you, too, for all of you who continue to financially support this podcast. It really takes the burden off of me. Other than that, let's go on and meet this very curious soul who's right ahead of us on the Terrace of Envy. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I'll see you soon.